236 on WGN. John Hanson here. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. And Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney, we think, will join us till 3 o'clock. Hi, Mike. I hope this connection's a little better than the cell phone was.
John, I'm so happy to be here. I don't know what my problem is. Sorry about that.
Well, I just love that, first of all, you have a landline still. That's awesome. Are you just holding on to that thing for dear life or what?
I'm old school, John. I'm going to keep it forever.
Well, I'm glad you have it today. I wish you, I can't believe the instinct wasn't there the first four times that the phone dropped on the cell phone that you didn't call on the landline, Mike.
Well, you blame it on WGN always, and then you blame it on the cell phone secondarily. So, you know, I'm a defense lawyer. I go with defense first, and then I go on the offense.
Boy, I'm really ribbing you for someone who I love to chat with here, and it always is so gracious to give us some of your time. You know it's a polite ribbing. You are the best, Mike, and we appreciate you joining us. I do have something that I want to chat about, but we have teased the social media thing so much that let's just put a bow on it. So Mark Zuckerberg went to the trial, and he had to be, you know, not facing Congress. He's facing a real lawyer, and a good one at that. And you say that a lot of the coverage showed that Zuckerberg maybe didn't fare so well in this trial.
Yeah, from the media commentary and from the transcripts from his testimony, I think he did a very poor job. I mean, first of all, it was a media circus. You have literally everybody covering this case because Zuckerberg's never testified under oath at a social media trial, which is huge, right? And then you also have outside the courthouse in L.A. literally hundreds to thousands of people, many of them parents whose kids have been impacted by social media, some of them whose kids have died by suicide. And so with the backdrop of all that, then Zuckerberg takes the stand. And despite the prep, seemed to really take a tone that was probably not advisable and seemed to be very, you know, aggressive and testy with the cross-examiner. And also, you know, got the I don't know-itis, which you never would want your witness to do, which is basically, hey, look, if you're on an email, you're on a document, you're on repeated emails and documents, to go with the idea that I just don't remember that email, I don't know if I saw it. It's just not very credible to a jury. And so he went that direction. But I think what was even more interesting is that we had talked about this a couple weeks ago, and we said basically the proof is going to be in the pudding. What are the internal documents that show what Meta, Facebook, Instagram knew? And there were some really damning documents talking about their knowledge of the use by 13-year-olds, by 10-year-olds, by 11-year-olds, and all the data they had gathered on usage of those young people. And he really didn't have an answer for it, other than to say, you know, we had talked about it amongst the team, but really didn't have to seem any good response to documents that he really knew were coming already.
As the, obviously, the president and CEO of Meta, and chairman of the board, I imagine that the buck really does stop with him. There's not like this, you know, if his testimony is taken poorly by the jury and they believe that he was either aloof at the wheel or perhaps negligent or even willfully negligent, I mean, that's kind of the whole thing, right, Mike? I was trying to, like, come up with a scenario in which you could say, well, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's a busy guy. He's not going to know the ins and outs of everything that happens in his company. But he's the chairman. He's the CEO. At the end of the day, it's his decision. And what his decision is ends up representing what Meta does and whether they're held responsible. Am I right in making that big of a leap?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of company cases where the company's a defendant, it's a different scenario where we have executive-level witnesses that testify. And their knowledge oftentimes isn't as direct as Zuckerberg's is. I mean, Zuckerberg is really intimately involved with all the things that they do and has been going back for years and years. And I think there was testimony that came out during this week where he basically said he can't be removed from his position. So the buck does stop there, and he certainly was aware of and admitted knowledge of these emails, even though now he's trying to claim, you know, limited knowledge. But yeah, it's a real tough position for him to be in. And then now they're going to follow that testimony up with internal whistleblowers who are going to say they blew the whistle on these various issues about, you know, usages by 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds, et cetera, years ago, and the company didn't do anything in response. So I'd say the trial so far is going, you know, as good as it could go for the plaintiff side, and I think there's a little doom, a cloud of doom hanging over the defendants right now at this point in the trial.
I don't know if this is going to make any sense what I'm about to say, which I could preface about basically every question I ask here on WGN, but he says that, you know, oh, I'm not really aware of that email, or I haven't thought about it, or whatever he says that seems, you know, aloof or whatever adjective you want to use. But Mike, you know, there are a lot of things that people, when they run companies or just in our everyday lives, we do forget. How much prep does a plaintiff's attorney provide to a defense attorney to prepare someone to answer questions that you want answered, right? Like, I guess what I'm asking is like, was there any information shared like, hey, we're going to be talking about these specific emails. Why don't you study up on them so we can get to the bottom of this in front of the jury? Or is that not at all how this works? Do you kind of see what I'm asking?
Yeah, so the discovery process in a civil case, which is, you know, different than a criminal case, everything's produced, you know, by both sides, right? All the documents, there's extensive document production. Also, there's depositions, and I don't know if he was deposed first in this case, but there's no secret what are going to be the hot documents. You know, in any case, when you're preparing a witness, you're like preparing them for the worst documents are out there. Like, what are the our Achilles heel? What makes you look bad? You know, what are they bound to cover? And it's usually pretty obvious, particularly when the focus on is on addicting young people. You obviously know that these documents are going to be front and center. And you can't, on the one hand, take the position that, oh, I just don't recall these emails, when you simultaneously admit you were in specific discussions about these sort of topics. You know, it doesn't work that way. You know, you can't conveniently get out, particularly in a guy like Zuckerberg's shoes, who really is intimately involved in all the decision-making. So he's a little different situated than other executives of companies.
Right. It's not as gotcha moment-y as maybe a criminal case would be.
Correct. But, you know, I mean, the jury certainly enjoys in a civil case of somebody like him, you know, one of the richest guys in the world, to be confronted with really damaging documents and see how they respond, see how they squirm. The jury loves that. And so they were eagerly waiting for him to testify. And I think that in terms of the drama, I think it delivered just like it might in a criminal case.
Mike, I'm sure you haven't had a chance really to read too much about the tariff decision. I was reading through, I've gotten through most of the decision, including Thomas's dissent. Have you read much about the tariff case? Any thoughts on the Supreme Court essentially striking down the president's maybe biggest, most what he trumpets as his most effective domestic policy so far of the year?
Yeah, well, I think one thing that I think is really heartening is that from a public PR standpoint, it really puts the Supreme Court in a different light, much more favorable light to the public, when, you know, the idea was prior to this that they weren't going to, you know, toss aside or reverse any case that he was involved in. And you had a case where the Chief Justice and other conservative justices joined him in the decision and went against Trump. So I think from a public perspective, I think that's good to see. But I think that the troubling part of the case is that it's very narrow. It was essentially analyzing whether Trump had the authority under a particular statute to enact and carry out these tariffs. And the answer they found was no. However, that's just analyzing under that particular act, whether that gave him the basis to do it. And so as you see today and yesterday, they're still going to pursue a policy of these tariffs using other authority, a different statute. So it's sort of a win for the day, but not a win after 48 hours.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know if the Supreme Court would want to surmise and then analyze the other aspects. Was the plaintiffs asking for a universal judgment against the president in terms of he simply does not have this authority under any statute? Did they argue that in the oral arguments? I don't remember. I guess I just wonder, like, what the standard operating procedure is for the Supreme Court on how narrow or how wide to get with the decision.
Yeah, and we've had this discussion before. They really are stuck with the issue before them, whether it's narrow or broad. And this case was brought by some small businesses who were directly and deeply impacted by the tariffs in a negative way.
Out of Vernon Hills,
And so their argument was because the president did state that he was acting under this particular statute, right? So, and he gave a basis, his administration gave a basis why they were imposing the tariffs under that particular statute, which gives the president emergency powers in certain limited instances. And so the Trump administration had taken the position that we're doing this under this act, invoking these emergency powers because of the importation of drugs into the United States and because of trade deficits, which the Supreme Court said neither of those are applicable and justify what he did. So the court was not allowed to and wouldn't go beyond that and say, gee, could Trump do it under some other law, because that's not before them. And so they never do that. They keep their decision to the law at issue and the facts at issue in their case.
I loved the Gorsuch concurrence. I don't know if you had a chance to read it, Mike. I want to read a little bit from this. But Neil Gorsuch said that for those who think it's important for the nation to impose more tariffs, I understand that today's decision will be disappointing. But all I can offer them is that the most major decisions affecting the rights and responsibilities of the American people are funneled through the legislative process for a reason. Yes, legislating can be hard and take time. And yes, it can be tempting to bypass Congress when some pressing problem arises. But the deliberative nature of the legislative process was the whole point of its design. Through that process, the nation can tap the combined wisdom of the people's elected representatives, not just that of one faction or man. And I can't imagine many people who would disagree with that overall sentiment, despite presidents of both parties trying to go around the legislative process. I felt like that was a win for the separation of powers agreement and a win for any originalist who believes in these three branches co-equal.
Yeah, because obviously one of the big issues at play in this particular decision by the Supreme Court was the application of the United States Constitution, which gives Congress the powers, it appears on its face, to do things like tariffs, excises, duties. So the argument has always been that the president, the executive branch, doesn't have this power. And so in a way to get around the Constitution or to come up with a basis for the tariffs, the Trump administration relied upon a particular different statute, not the Constitution, but a particular law as a basis to invoke emergency power. So no matter what aisle you're on, Republican or Democrats, you know, especially in the Republican side, the argument's always made that we should be true to the Constitution, and certainly the decision was true to the Constitution.
Yeah, I read through Clarence Thomas's dissent. He argues a lot about the original, you know, he often goes back to English law to try and get in the minds of the founders when they wrote the document and what they carried over and what they didn't from the island, and sometimes that can be problematic. I find it problematic, too, and so did Neil Gorsuch in this case. He went to the Boston Tea Party and said, do you really think that the people who were in Boston in that harbor complaining about it, essentially a tariff and a tax, were to then impose and allow the monarch, essentially the king, the lead of the executive, that whole power to do so? That wouldn't seem to be what those people in Boston would have then turned around and done in their own constitution, which I thought was a great argument.
Yeah, I love that argument. Yeah, I mean, it's just, I think from a perspective of rebalance, don't you feel like that this was good in that just from a public relations standpoint, for people to feel like, well, the Supreme Court's not just going to do what the governing political party wants them to do. They're going to have the backbone, or they're going to rely upon the law or their view of the Constitution and not just do whatever the executive wants, whether it's a Republican executive or Democratic executive. Don't you think this is important just from that perspective?
Yes. I think any check on the president, whoever the president is, including the Supreme Court in the New Deal, striking down some of the overreaches of the presidency, to the student loan forgiveness, which if you agree or disagree about it, may have been an executive action that was too far and outside the bounds of the legislative process by the Biden administration. I think it's always important when the Supreme Court steps in a little bit and exerts some muscle that perhaps the legislative branch has not been able to do over the past couple decades. That's a John Hansen aside, not a WGN aside, but I'm going to, Mike, put you on hold here and we're going to tackle one more thing before we go. Okay.
Sounds great, buddy. Appreciate it.
More after this on Let's Get Legal on WGN. Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney. Mike, before each show I go on WGN, I usually take a peek back at old newspapers, like a This Day in History thing from 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 25 years ago. I just peek around because it often provides a little interesting fodder for conversation or little interesting nuggets. Interesting, I guess, is in the eye of the beholder or the ears of the beholder in this case, Mike. I don't know if the listeners agree, but I love history, so I do it. And I pulled up the Tribune from 25 years ago today, and there's a couple interesting cases on the front page that I saw that I thought I'd kind of chat with you about. Are you cool with that?
I'm cool. I'm just worried. Do you have like stacks of papers in your home? You're kind of like a hoarder, and you just go to the stack and
no.
Go to 1972 from the living room and pull that out. Is that how this works?
No, I pay $19.99 a month for my newspapers.com subscription, which gives me access to basically every newspaper that's been digitized going back to like the 1600s. So I've actually gone back and read the newspapers from Philadelphia that published the Declaration of Independence for the first time. I find it to be a fascinating thought exercise in my own head and a slightly less than fascinating radio segment.
You could have laughed at my joke first before you went to that very serious answer.
Right. I did laugh. I chuckled. You just missed it because you're on a landline. Okay. So the first headline, which was the big story of the day, U.S. says FBI agent spied for Russia. 25 years ago today is when the government announced that the veteran FBI counterintelligence agent, who was a Chicago cop, and this later got turned into a movie, Robert Philip Hansen, was a double agent for Russia for a long time, led to many deaths of CIA agents, I think two of them, and worked with the KGB during the Cold War, then afterwards. And what's it, Bridge of Spies, I think, is the movie. I don't know if you've seen that one, Mike. It's a good one. But that was 25 years ago.
I know what you're talking about. That was a fascinating story. I mean, it's amazing that you can get to somebody at that level just based upon money / maybe pride and ego. I mean, it's incredible that you can buy a person of that level, and that it went on for so long, and that their own agency could not figure it out. That's what's crazy about it.
The other, there's two more headlines. One was mom wins asylum for son with autism. It was a fascinating case that Immigration and Naturalization Services had to tackle, where a Pakistani woman and her son, who had severe autism, claimed refugee status that Pakistan had handled. I don't know how it's changed in the last quarter century. I'm sure it has slightly, but that they did not treat children with different needs, especially autism, in a positive way, that he would be relegated to the outskirts of society. And INS sided with the woman and agreed to asylum. And they made clear to say that this doesn't mean any person can bring any child with any disability, but that the circumstances in Pakistan were so dire for children that it allowed her and her son to stay in the United States. And now I want to find and dig around and see if I can find if she's still here and follow up. But that's an interesting one, Mike.
Oh, yeah, that's cool. And it's funny because we sometimes take for granted rights that we have and things that we think would be, you know, normal today. And you kind of forget that what it took to get some of those decisions, particularly one like that 25 years ago.
And then the last one, which really impacts you, I wonder if you've had any cases impacted by this. With 2 minutes left in the show, Supreme Court says police can detain suspects outside of homes. This was from a Central Illinois case. The Supreme Court ruled that police did not violate Charles MacArthur's constitutional rights when they refused to let him go inside his house trailer while they got a search warrant. The court, in an 8-1 vote, said police in Sullivan, Illinois, acted responsibly. They briefly kept him outside because they reasoned he would have destroyed the drugs inside his trailer had he gone in. Now, maybe helping the case for them was MacArthur himself admitted he would have done so if he had had the opportunity. But an interesting study of the sanctity of the home versus police's idea, desire to maintain evidence. What an interesting one.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've had to come up in cases where they're in hot pursuit of somebody and the person runs into their home, which is kind of a derivation of this. Basically, the idea that you're in the midst of a commission of a crime, kind of a little bit differently. So I'm not surprised by the decision. And, you know, the sanctity of home is very much diminished over the years in terms of criminal cases. So it doesn't surprise me. The only thing that surprises me is that was 25 years ago.
I'd have to read more about whether they had gotten the warrant, but the paperwork hadn't arrived at the house, or whether they were still, you know, going through the process of getting the warrant. And then it becomes, well, how long can you hold someone, and what cases can you or can you not do it? I guess you mentioned that's only 25 years ago. I don't know. It always just reminds me of how evolving these things are, whether it's the Supreme Court case yesterday or so many other ones, how our laws are written are up to so much interpretation and change so much over the years. I don't know. Mike, it's not a perfect system, but I think it's a system that works pretty darn well.
I think so, especially when you win a case. And this week we got two victories defending university students who, in our view, were wrongfully accused of violations and maintained their residence in their school. So that was exciting for us. That was kind of the highlight for the week.
All right. Here's another highlight for you. 630 says, so glad you had Mike Leonard on after all the phone issues. He's my favorite of all your lawyers. I learn a lot. And went on to ask a couple questions, which I'm going to have to pin for the next time you're on. And Mike, I don't think that's you texting your own show right now, but
I was just going to say, I'm glad my wife is listening today. She never listens. So it's got to be her.
Mike, I appreciate it. Thanks for dealing with the phone issues. You're the best. We'll talk soon. Okay.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely.